Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm so glad that we get to be together, whether we are here in this room or together on the Zoom room. It is good to see you all this morning. The question that I would like you to explore with me this morning is, what does good look like? In our Buddhist communities and our sanghas, we have what we call precepts. We have vows that we take. And there are intentions for how we want to live and how we want to live together. And the first three are about taking refuge, you know, where we ground ourselves, where we put our trust. We say we take refuge in Buddha as teacher, and we take refuge in Dharma as teaching, and we take refuge in Sangha as community. We use these to frame how we want to live together. And after these three, after taking refuge, the next three are what we call the three pure precepts. And we say this: with purity of heart, I vow to do no harm. With purity of heart, I vow to do good. With purity of heart, I vow to free all beings. And these are so beautiful. They feel good when I say them. And at the same time, I realize how very non-specific that is. They're very non-situational. They're aspirational. I vow to do good. What does that look like? And I think it would be really helpful for us, especially when things feel really hard, to practice imagining what we see as good. Like, what could this look like? What could good look like? And one of the places we can start this morning, I thought, is with, you know, our land acknowledgements and our ancestor acknowledgements that we do on Sunday mornings. You know, we recognize the harm done to the Dakota and the Anishinaabe peoples who thrived here once on this land. What could good have looked like if the people who came here had chosen differently? And what could good look like now, as we continue to work in the ripples of that, because it's still here? I think practicing imagining what good could look like helps us, because then we can look forward and maybe we can see where harm was done and we can do it differently. We acknowledge the harm done to the Black communities and the loss of the Rondo neighborhood here. What could good have looked like if the people in power had chosen differently, if they had different vows? And what do we look like now? What can we imagine good looking like if we could do that differently now? What do we do in the wake of those ripples? We can contemplate our continuation of Buddhist practice and how we as American practitioners have engaged with these Asian traditions and the people who introduced us to these vows that we hold. We're so grateful to be able to practice, to learn. But even the most well-meaning people can do harm. So how do we engage with that? How do we choose good? The first six precepts, the refuges and the pure precepts, they kind of give us a direction for where we're going. And the other 10 that we have, the 10 grave precepts, they do get more specific. In the beginning, they were stated as, I vow not to lie, or do not lie, or do not steal. You know, they were something that you could get a better idea of maybe what good looked like, but there's something we need to understand them and to practice them and to really embody them. And I wish they were easy to define. Like, just because we say, I vow to do good, doesn't mean that we necessarily and automatically will. I wish there were a button. Like, I vow to do good, and after that, it would just magically happen. Does anybody remember Calvin and Hobbes, the comic strip? Oh, I see lots of hands. This is fun. For those of you who don't know, Calvin and Hobbes was a comic strip that ran from 1985 to 95 by a wonderful man named Bill Watterson. And he had such an imagination, and he was such an interesting thinker. So Calvin was a six-year-old boy, and Hobbes was his stuffed tiger, who, of course, when no one else was around, was not a stuffed tiger, but a real tiger. And they had all sorts of adventures and conversations. Calvin was six. He was incredibly intelligent for his age and very philosophical, but he was not wise. Hobbes was the wise voice. But does anybody remember Calvin's cardboard box? He had a big cardboard box that he turned into many things. It was a time machine, and it was a transmogrifier, which turned him into other things. And it was a duplicator once, which he made because he wanted somebody else to have around to do what he didn't want to do. But this didn't turn out well, because when the duplicates he made also had his personality, and they didn't want to do it either. So that didn't go so well. So one time he came up with this idea, and he was feeling like he didn't want to do the things he had to do anymore. And so he was going to duplicate himself again. But this time he added an ethicator. He took his duplicator box and he wrote good, bad, and drew an arrow to good. And then he duplicated himself. So he only duplicated the good part, the part that would follow the rules. And the good self was good for a while, and it followed the rules. But then good Calvin and original Calvin got into a fight, and good Calvin realized that he had done something bad, and he went poof. So no more good Calvin. So the button thing, as much as it's wishful thinking, it's more complicated than that. And we don't have a good bad setting that we can just switch to. And this can be confusing and tiring. And so what we do as human beings is we try to clear things up. We try to decide what's good and what's bad. And we do this with good intentions. I mean, even in our tradition, like right from the beginning, Buddha saw the need for guidelines when the Sangha started forming, which is how our precepts and rules, you know, started to be established in the first place. In our morning services, when we take the refuge, we say, I take refuge in Sangha. May all beings support harmony in the community, free from hindrance. The precepts and the rules that were created to cultivate peace within ourselves and to cultivate peace in our communities with others. And so this is what we do. We set up rules. But we know how unharmonious this can get. I mean, watch the news right now. Our society is very, very angry about a lot of rules that have been made or have not been made, or we wish would we be. That, and if we think that we just have the right laws in place, that we will be, then that will be good. And we will have defined what good is. And we hope that by making more specific laws, things will get easier and clearer. But sometimes it only gets more complicated. And especially if we find we're relying on rules that are written down in order to create that sense of being good. And it was no different for the early Buddhists. The rules that started to get written down, there were more and more and more of them. And finally, what's cataloged right now that's called the Vinaya or monastic rule, there are 227 rules for the monks and 311 for the nuns. They needed more. And so these are still followed by some Buddhist lineages today who are really trying hard to observe these rules. We keep trying to figure out what good looks like. In our Mahayana tradition within Buddhism, we have these 16 broad precepts, the ones that I've talked about. And having 16, they stay generalized. And so that makes practice really alive for us because we get to work with them. We recognize the need to choose in every moment with our best awareness in the scope of these precepts, what we hope is doing good. And our meditation practice prepares us and strengthens us. It strengthens our awareness, our ability to see ourselves, to be aware of what we're doing and the impact of what we're doing. You know, we get to practice paying attention to the ripples we're making. And we as a community, we keep an ongoing practice of this, monthly full moon ceremonies where we focus on the precepts. And I'll talk about that a little later. But even now we have a class going on dedicated to these 10 wonderful precepts, as the class is called. And there's 14 people who are studying them, and 7 of them will take Jukai in the fall, which is a full embracing of these vows and ceremony. So we keep working with these and we keep finding ways to engage with them within ourselves and with each other. And these have grown on me. And I grew up with the Ten Commandments, and so I was very familiar with the 10 thou shalt not. And I was really wary when I began practice of more nots, of more don'ts. And I'm very grateful that Dogen, you know, the founder of our lineage, he created positive sides to these as well. And so the first version I learned was, I vow not to kill, but to nurture life. It wasn't just don't, but it was also in the face of don't, here's what to engage with. But I've come to the realization that starting with don't is not actually such a bad place to start. It's kind of like, you know, the first thing that you do if you realize you're doing something harmful is to stop doing it. This seems fairly straightforward. And it makes me giggle because it's kind of, I've been reminded lately of that joke where the guy goes to the doctor and says, doctor, it hurts when I do this. And the doctor says, well, stop doing that. It's not a bad place to start. If you realize that you are doing something that creates pain for yourself or other people, stop doing it. But then what? I find I am given gifts from unexpected places. The Calvin and Hobbes I was reading just for fun one day turned into the Ethicator story. And the other thing that I have been reading lately is Rita Gross's book called Buddhism Beyond Patriarchy. And it's a wonderful book, very, very well researched and insightful. But she talks so much about ethics in there too, and includes the precepts. And I was delighted to be reading that as I was thinking about this. And she writes in one section about taking up the practice of ethical conduct. And I'd like to read you what she says because she wrote it so beautifully. As Shila, or ethics, is taught, the message is one of restraint, of self-cultivation through non-harming and contemplation. It is important to pull back for a while, to pull into oneself and to develop the foundations of sane and wholesome habits. Oh, I love that phrase. Sane and wholesome habits and modes of interacting. In the beginning of the journey, one may not have the capacity or the ability to worry about saving others. It is enough, and she's clear that this is for the time being, it is enough to take care of oneself and to tame habitual negative patterns to some extent. If one's negative patterns are tempered, that will be quite helpful, not only to oneself, but also to others. She put this so clearly for me, and I was grateful to read it. You know, it reminds me that our meditation practice is so helpful because we purposely slow down enough to take a good look at our own thoughts first, our own actions first. We can stop causing harm. We can begin healing. After all, that's the end of the, the real story with the doctor's office, right? You stop causing pain, but that's not the end of it. Then you learn how to heal. That's the real challenge then. And Rita Gross went on to write here, because if we insist on saving the world while we still mainly act out of passion, aggression, and ignorance, we don't have much to work with, and we actually create more harm than help. As bodhisattvas, as people who are dedicated to awakening and helping, it's our responsibility to develop some skills. Imagine you want to be a lifeguard. Saving others from drowning. This is fantastic. Here's the first question. Do you know how to swim? This is probably important. Because we have this image of like maybe being a lifeguard up in the chair, away from the pool. It's not just sitting up in a chair and blowing a whistle and yelling at people to stop diving in the shallow end. First, you need to learn how to swim. And to stay calm under pressure. You are the one who needs to know how to respond when people are panicking and angry, and that means you know how to not panic. And to learn to work with our own kind of inborn fear of drowning, then we can start being really helpful. But it starts in here. Part of the Dhammapada, which is a collection of the Buddha's earliest teachings, talks of how someone who is self-restrained and always live with mastery is a person who has true strength. And that internal strength is greater than the ability to control or conquer others or to make somebody do something. We develop that internal strength, and that is the real mastery. Meditation isn't passive. It's active preparation and participation in our bodhisattva training to be awake and alive and helpful. Our meditation practice is part of learning how to swim. It's practicing how to live. So studying with the precepts and learning to engage with them and really embody them is so crucial. Like we really get that sense of who we want to be. And we get to be more familiar with the people that we want to be and what good can look like. And so in the face of challenging situations, we can imagine what good looks like and we can follow through on what we think that might look like. You know, the precepts are so personal. They're not, I mean, it can be seen as rules written down by somebody else, but the precepts, when we really practice with them, our actions and our motivations come from inside. So remember I talked about Good Calvin? Good Calvin was, he showed up, he got out of bed on time, he made his bed, he put on his clothes, he came down for breakfast, he went to school, he answered his teacher's questions, he was nice to the girl next door instead of throwing snowballs at her. He, you know, all of the things that he did were the manifestation of what he thought was good. I'd encourage you to, I can tell you which book this is from later. It's really fascinating, the dynamics of this. But Calvin's ethicator self was based on rules that other people had set for him. And the way that he went through his days as Good Calvin was just obeying the rules. And it was completely joyless. And there was no understanding. I mean, I understand he's six, but this is something that we can extrapolate on. You know, what is it to just obey the rules versus life coming from you inside of you of what you really imagine a good world to look like? You know, when we are children, we learn to obey rules. As we get older, we can learn to understand, which is different. we can embody these vows about respect and harmony. This is developing maturity. And there is joy in that, because we get to understand, we get to see the ripples. And I like that we have the invitation to do this. A Zen teacher named Norman Fisher out in California, I was reading a transcript of a talk he gave about the precepts. And again, he said something so beautiful, so I'm just going to use his words. How did we get from strict precepts to Dogen's 16 precepts? In Zen, the sense is very explicit that the teacher is not the sutra and not the Vinaya, which is the monastic rule. The teacher is the spirit of the Buddha, the mind and the heart of the Buddha, which is your mind and your heart. So we are sure, we are to follow that mind and that heart rather than the letter of the sutra or the letter of the law. These precepts are vows. They're not about just obeying things that have been written down. They're not just about a perception of good. Because good can also very much look like asking difficult questions within community. Good can actually look like challenging what's been written down. Because that's how we learn whether we can really embody it or not. We really take it into ourselves. It's not just being silent and dutiful. But we practice, we take on this personal responsibility, and we do it with humility and accountability. Those two things are really, really important. Especially lately, I have been really taking those to heart. Because learning how to swim can be hard. I mean, we're joining a universe in progress, right? We don't start and have everything with a clean slate. It's kind of like the idea of awareness or glimpses of awareness or waking up being like standing up and realize that you're standing in the middle of a rushing river. And all of a sudden deciding what to do rather than just getting carried away by the current can feel really hard. And yet this is our life. We get to decide what direction we go. We get to decide how we choose. Now we have ripples of our own to create. And we affect the river. In the midst of trying really hard, we also get to be gentle with ourselves. We need to be gentle with ourselves and with others. We don't start off being experts. And so we get to be humble. We get to try our best and be humble. Both and. Because awareness comes in stages. I mean, for a long time, we spend time doing things and we don't even know we're doing them. And then with a little bit more awareness, we do things and then we notice we did them. Like, oh, oops. And then after a while, with more awareness, we start to see things before we do them. And then we have the choice. Is this something that I envision creating good ripples? Is this something I imagine is good? And if it's not, we get to apologize. And we get to make amends. It's not a go directly to jail, do not pass, go sort of situation. We get to keep practicing together. You know, we start small and we get stronger. I really love Rita Gross's phrase of those sane and wholesome actions. Sane is a really good word. It doesn't need to be huge and dynamic. It can just be really grounded. And the more we see and the more we do, we become stronger swimmers. One of the things that I also stumbled upon that she wrote was she talks about how in the scope of, you know, meditation is an individual practice, and then us as practitioners affecting the greater world outside of ourselves, you know, because this can be a concern sometimes that Buddhist practice or meditation is too self-focused and not greater picture focused. But we can take that time to develop these base skills that we have. We can learn a few basic swimming strokes. And then Rita Gross wrote about how this clearer, wiser, calmer perspective actually benefits our involvement in greater social concerns. She wrote, as prajna or wisdom develops, one sees more clearly what needs to be done and how to do it. So she's saying we'll be able to see better what good looks like. And she wrote, this provides a reservoir of strength and humor. I liked that part. Strength and humor that can help protect from heartbreak and burnout, thus protecting and strengthening one's ability to stay with a cause despite setbacks for the long term. So she talks about as we develop a patient and diligent practice, we can become people who are more clear, more skilled at clearly seeing what could be done and how we could engage with it. And I talked about how I learned to appreciate the do not part of the precepts, the stop part, but we also have a go part. And that's something that Dogen introduced when he crafted the precepts that we use today. And there are so many different versions and different translations. People have chosen different wordings of them, but it's not just the don't. There's an invitation into what do could look like. And I love that we can give ourselves that direction. Because it helps us if we stop doing something, well, what are my options for what I'm supposed to be doing now? And one of the things that helps me think of this is, like, imagine that you decided to be healthy, that you wanted to cultivate greater health in your life, and you decided that one place where you wanted to do it was food. And you start with, okay, I'm not going to eat donuts anymore. That's a good start. But if you spend your day walking around going, I'm not going to eat donuts, I'm not going to eat french fries, I'm not going to eat ice cream, I'm not going to eat this, I'm not going to eat this, and you spend your whole day deciding what you're not going to eat, what will the frame of mind be if you walk around only thinking about what you don't want and what you can't have? Instead of the idea of, okay, I will acknowledge that this is a list of things that I'm not going to choose for my body because it's not nourishing. What I'm going to focus on, where I'm going to put my heart and my mind, is on buying nourishing food when I'm at the grocery store so that it's in my kitchen. I am going to practice asking friends for good recipes so that I can learn to cook really well, things that are really tasty. So it's important to acknowledge the parts that, like, this is not healthy for me. It's good to name that. But the focus, I think, is so much more helpful for our aspirations if we focus on what we would like to cultivate rather than what we don't want to do. Acknowledge the harm. Attend to the hurt. But focus on what you want to be. Focus on the world you want to see and work towards that. When we practice, you know, these precepts are so general, but we get to make them so personal. Even having 16 can feel overwhelming sometimes. I'd encourage you to just pick one at a time. We do this here already. Every month we have a full moon precept ceremony where we know in advance which precept we are going to be looking at. And we spend time together taking these vows and talking about a particular precept, what it means to us, and we hear other people's ideas. But pick one at a time. The next ceremony is on Wednesday, July 13th, and that one's going to be Zoomed directly from Hokkyoji, so you can join from wherever you are. But it's going to be the fourth precept, which says this: listening and speaking from the heart, I take up the way of not speaking falsely. We have copies of our precepts in the chant books. They're also online. The chant book is available for anybody who wants to look for it. And so what I would encourage you to do is pick one, maybe pick this one. There's only a week or so before that next ceremony. Write one down, stick it in your pocket, tape it to somewhere where you see it when you wake up in the morning, and walk through your day. Touch the paper in your pocket. What does not speaking falsely look like in my life right now? What do I wish it would look like? What does good look like? What's the spirit behind this? Practice it in ways where you just keep it close. And then we get to come together and we get to talk about it and we get to renew these statements of who we want to be and how we want to be together. This is how we embody that statement of supporting harmony in the community. We really look at this. At the end of the ceremony, after we recite all the precepts, the Doan plays the instruments, says this: our words ring out through space beyond the stars. Their virtue and compassion echo back from all the many beings. We recite the precepts for the renewal of the Buddha mind in fields and forests, homes and streets, throughout the world, in grateful thanks to all our many guides along the ancient way. I'm glad we get to share this. And I like that it talks about our guides. I mean, I'm grateful for all the guides who have helped me, even just as I have been preparing this talk. Buddha, Dogen, Rita Gross, Bill Watterson. We find these things all over the place. They've helped me imagine what good looks like. And I'm curious now to hear how you work with these vows yourself. Who guides you? What helps you? I'd like to thank you for being here and invite you to share. And if you are on Zoom, you can place questions or comments into the chat, or you can unmute yourself. We will do our best. Yes. Oh, we have a friend.
A friend.
Yes. Jiren.
Can I take this off when we talk?
I think so.
Yes.
I mean, for Zoom. You know, the dialectic of good and evil, I think it can be a trap because good and evil interpenetrate each other and they're not separate. And last night I went to the Jungle Theater to see the Cambodian rock musical, which is brilliant if you can get to it. And it was stunningly funny and stunningly penetrating. And, you know, in genocide situations, you know, every person is imprinted with all the harm that's being done to them. Or a boarding school, it's imprinted in a five-year-old, the harm, and it comes back out. And any kind of internalized hatred is inside the body. And so to think that I can just be good is, it's sort of missing the point of being intimate with all mind states and all beings and trying to find virtue and trying to find these places of equanimity. And but actually, I even think going for like Brahma Viharis and spending my time with the, you know, mudita, loving kindness, can be spiritual bypass. So it's a complicated situation to recognize that the harm that's perpetrated on individuals has been caused in part by me wanting to be averse and staying good instead of being intimate with my role in how this perpetration is happening. So, I mean, I was on the front line in DC and there was an African-American young man, really angry, speaking with the microphone. It was really hard to hear. I wanted to just like do this. And there were lots of priests and not Buddhist priests necessarily, but Christian and all religions, it was interfaith. And we actually got lectured because the religious people doing good gave him the message that he wasn't okay and that they were tone police for him. So we got lectured about it is not our job to tone police other people and that we have no idea what it's like to live on the front line year after year or to be deeply disenfranchised by actions we've actually taken. So it's really complicated, and I have it in me so much what would look like evil that the only way I can kind of get to the nut of it is by giving out love and like trying to be non-judgmental with the with the aversions that arise in me. So anyway, I appreciate this talk because it challenges me to notice how complicated it is to be human. Thank you.
Thank you, Jiren.
Yeah.
And I think of everything that I have ever encountered, what you're saying reminds me is that practice starts here.
Yeah.
Because we can't control what anyone thinks of us. And we can't control, there are so many things we have no control over. And your comment about how easy it is for us to bypass things is something that scares me too. You know, how easy it is for us to fool ourselves. And this is why we have Sangha. This is why we have friends. So our practice is personal. And then we invite others to practice with us so that they can care for us and we can trust them to help us if they see things about us that we don't. And then we do our best to enter the world where we are and we offer what we have and we keep trying to do what we hope is helpful. Thank you. Somebody on Zoom have a
chat?
No, it's just
a note.
Carla would like to say thank you for your words.
Well, thank you, Carla. Hey, Zach.
Hi. I am one of the people that you mentioned that's going through the Jukai process right now. So we're working pretty intimately with the precepts. And one thing that I notice is that if they are seen as something from the outside that's imposed these rules to follow, they don't have nearly as much strength. And the more that you look at them, the more you examine your own responses to them and sort of what comes up in terms of resistances or clinging, they become your own. And then their power is undeniable. Right? I mean, you can, you know, once you've seen something, it's much, much harder not to follow that supposed rule that comes from somewhere else, because when it comes from within, it's just yours.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That is what I love so much about being able to wrestle with these and to ask questions and see how they interact with all of the things that are swimming around inside of us. Like Jiren said, like all of the things that we've inherited and all the things that everyone else has inherited and experienced. That's why I like that part of the Dhammapada, like that the real strength is not controlling anything outside. The real strength is when it's in here. Thank you for bringing that up. We can close if there's no one else who has anything else to share. I'm okay with that.
Oh, there is a question.
Oh. Uh-oh.
Fuku asks, any thoughts about repentance?
Well, that's beautiful. I mean, this is what happens, you know, because we're not going to be perfect. Any expectation, like we're going to disappoint ourselves. We're going to disappoint each other. And that's part of the thing that I kind of went over really fast, which is that humility and accountability are so important. That's all, like a whole other half hour of talking about things. The importance of humility, and that's not thinking that you're a bad person. That's not degrading yourself. It's saying, oh, I realize I did something I didn't want to do. I realized something that caused harm. And so we get to, you know, maybe we notice this in ourselves before we even are approached by anyone else who has been harmed by things that we have done. You know, maybe we get to see that first, or maybe it takes a friend who is brave enough to tell us when we're going a little out of line or when we've caused harm or hurt them. It's a gift to have people who are brave enough to tell you when you've messed up. And then you get to be humble and you get to say, oh. And then you get to offer that repentance. Years ago, when I was in a Christian church, repentance was explained to me as a turning. That you were going in one direction, but then you were turning to go in a different direction, that's where the base of repentance was. And that reminds me of so much of the way the precepts are, like, don't do this, do this instead. And so that repentance is that practice of humility and changing direction. And maybe you find yourself back in that old direction a couple of times before you really manage to change your bearings enough. But we keep practicing. Is that helpful?
It's valid.
Thank you.
I have a question.
Oh. Hi, Kim.
Hi there. Can you speak more about following the rules versus just awareness of reality? I'm really curious about that. Being raised Catholic, it really resonated with me.
Thank you. I grew up in similar settings where it was very important that you didn't need to understand the rules. You just needed to do them. And I think Zach actually spoke to that so beautifully. Like, when you really practice with them yourself, you're really like, okay, it says don't do that. Why? What happens when I do that? And why do I not value what happens when I do that? And so I think one of the things, and Zen practice and Buddhist practice has plenty of its own tradition and stodginess in places. But technically, it is a practice of questions where we get to ask anything. And it's supposed to be an exploration deep into everything. So we have permission to ask and to wrestle with these things and not to just take someone else's word for it. I think that's one of my favorite teachings of the Buddha. Don't just do it because I said something. Experience it for yourself. And I think that practice of internalizing things and questioning things and making it your own is what turns things from rules into aspirations and to guidelines for yourself. And then they're yours. And then you act from that place where you have really internalized them. Is that kind of what you were going for?
Thank you. I was curious just your take on it. I've been practicing a lot with the five remembrances, and I was thinking in terms of change, thinking of you read it in one part of your life and then you interpret it in a certain way. And even in a different moment, you might interpret it in a different way. That's how I was interpreting it.
That's really beautiful. After all, we do have a practice of recognizing the impermanence of everything. And so we get to adapt and we get to change. Thank you, Kim.
Thank you.
And now we are good. Yeah. Thank you, everyone.